Hi, everyone, and welcome to Oscar Wilde, a podcast about film, always counting down to next year's Oscars. I'm Sophia Simonello.
And I'm Nick Rickrout.
And today we have our first New York Film Festival recap. We took a little break week last week because we have just been watching so many movies, spending so much time up at Lincoln Center. This is always, I think, our favorite time of the year. So I can't wait to dig into some of these films that we've seen. Quite a few of them together, which I think will also be fun to discuss. And yeah, talk about, I think, what's a really exciting Oscar race so far, because it seems wide open. This is the first time we've had a wide open year in a long time.
Yeah, I do like that feeling. And in a way, it's making me go into the festival pretty open-minded and to not expect, like, you know, having out of Cannes a Best Actress frontrunner or something in the Best Picture category, that I'd be like, okay, I'm excited for this. Let's see it happen in real time and be disappointed maybe. And I think it's allowing me to see all these movies on their own, make my own opinions, which I think makes for an even more exciting festival, let alone a lineup that is just out of this world. I've had a lot of fun with some of these movies. My festival time is almost over, but I have 8 movies before I finish. Sounds like a lot, but it's still less than half. So it's been quite a ride, and I can't wait to talk about these movies. We'll have even more next week, including Anora, which I will say I did really enjoy. So I'm excited for that, and its wide release coming very soon.
Yeah. So before we dig into our New York Film Festival experience and some of these movies, we got, honestly, a life-changing announcement. For me in particular this week. Thank you to everyone for all of your messages, checking in, seeing how I'm feeling right now after 7 years without Daniel Day-Lewis. He announced, well, he didn't announce, it was revealed that he's coming out of retirement to work on his son Ronan Day-Lewis's first feature film, Anemone, which will be distributed by Focus Features. They're filming right now in Manchester. Samantha Morton and Sean Bean are also in the film. And Daniel Day-Lewis also co-wrote the script with his son. And we don't know much, of course. They're very cagey, as always. But it's just, we do know that it's about familial bonds and fathers and sons to some extent. I am so excited. I'm so happy. I knew that if he did come out of retirement, it would take something special, either PTA or a family member. I thought maybe Rebecca Miller, his wife, who's also a filmmaker. But this is interesting. I obviously am so excited. It's funny also because he always takes large breaks between films. So 7 years isn't really a retirement, but the announcement of a retirement and then the reveal that he will actually be coming back. I'm thrilled. Can't wait.
We've had multiple actors and filmmakers do this, so I'm not sure I ever felt worried for you, but I am happy that there is official news that his next movie is on the way, and I love that it's family-oriented. So let's get right into some New York Film Festival movies, starting with some that came from Cannes. So we had Misericordia that we both saw together, All We Imagine as Light, which won the Grand Prix Award at Cannes, and The Seed of the Sacred Fig, which won a special award. I would say my favorite of this bunch is The Seed of the Sacred Fig by Mohamed Brasalouf. We've talked about this one a few times this year, but I felt like it was such an exciting and timely slow burn of a movie. It's about this family whose father becomes almost like a judge in Iran, and he has to make this really difficult decision at work, whether to sign off on a death punishment or stick to his morals. And that coincides with the protests happening in real time, in real life, in Iran over wearing the hijab and many women burning them and protesting having to wear them. And it's a difficult watch because you see a lot of violence, and there's something that happened really close to the family, and it's the conflicting politics of an older and a new generation coming head to head and seeing that play out. And it's exciting. It's, again, difficult, but I think it's a really important watch. I currently have it as my front runner for international feature. It's a longer film, but I think it's warranted. And it has a third act that really ratchets up. It went somewhere that I didn't really expect. And I was fully on the ride. I loved it. Really recommend this when this comes out. And this is going to be released by Neon. The other two I enjoyed. We had this bit going in the beginning of the festival where there was like a boner reference, and we're like, okay, great. Second movie, same thing. Third movie, same thing. I'm like, what is happening here? What is happening? This also includes Megalopolis, which we will get to, but it was four movies in a row. And I texted you. I was like, oh, dear God, what is the next movie I'm seeing? It's Maria. And I'm like, oh, my God, I know you have seen this. I don't think this is going to be a movie with a boner. And it wasn't. But
I was going to say, thank God we were spared there, at least.
Quite a ride and not what I was expecting. And since, I have had more, including Jacob Elordi's butt in O Canada. I'm sorry, it's not a movie worth seeing just for that, but I did, and I kind of regret it.
Well, that makes me a little more excited to see O Canada, despite the fact that you gave it one star on Letterboxd. That actually makes me even more curious. Like, a very low rating for you and Jacob Elordi's butt, that feels like, I don't know, intriguing to me. So I'll see it, and we'll let you know what I think.
The low rating comes from similar to Megalopolis, where I was just watching the movie, watching the screen, feeling completely void of any emotion. And during O Canada, I had that same experience of I am watching this happen. I am disconnected from anything happening. Parts and shots and the music were lovely. Jacob Elordi just driving a car with that mustache. I could watch that for 2 hours. Fine. But the inner cutting of this troubled man of a dying generation and having this fractured timeline really wasn't for me. But the anti-war jockstrap was quite a sight.
Oh my God, I'm crying. Well, on that note, Seed of the Sacred Fig, I agree with you. I will say, though, so Neon is releasing this for our U.S. audiences. This comes out November 27th. This is Germany's international feature entry. I hope and hope and hope that this could win, because the movie that I have predicted to win, I do not care for, and that's Amelia Perez. But I loved The Seed of the Sacred Fig. I think that this movie is actually a really, really necessary entry into not just the Oscar race, but just cinema history, because Mohammad Rasoulof, who has fled an arrest warrant from the Iranian government, has not been able to make his movies for years. So this feels like a really important statement from him about the current political climate in Iran. And what I love about this movie is the way that the film starts. It is about the father. He gets that mysterious appointment, and we know who he's aligned with in Iranian politics. And the rest of the film, he's not really present for a good majority of it. It becomes a chamber piece in this family drama, mostly set in the apartment, about his wife and their two daughters, who are, like you said, from a different generation. They have different political views than their parents. And it's a slow burn. It's focused on how they feel. How they feel trapped, I think, within that environment, too. It is this, I think, microcosm of the isolation that women experience and how they feel in that political climate. But what I also loved is that with the father absent at work, his shadow looms large over them. And we also get to see the mother, her opinions change as everything hits closer to home and the girl's friend is injured in a protest. Rasoulof has a very steady hand. And then when that shift happens, like you were talking about with the third act, and the tension really ratchets up, I thought a lot of The Shining, which is a very odd comparison, I think, probably to make on the surface. But if you think about The Shining and how that ends and what the Jack Torrance character represents, but also that's kind of how the father is depicted here. And we think about that with the patriarchy. It was fascinating to me. I was just sitting there in awe. And I loved this movie so much. So highly recommend this one. And I also really recommend All We Imagine as Light. Misericordia, I wasn't as high on. I think I maybe had trouble with the tone and with locking into it. It just wasn't so much a movie for me. But with All We Imagine as Light, I think that Payal Kapadia does something really beautiful in blending these real perspectives of Mumbai with the fictional characters that she has in her narrative, these two women. And her documentary influence as a filmmaker, I think, really shines through. And the beginning actually reminded me a lot of Reds and how Warren Beatty uses real life subjects to blend in with this fictional narrative to create, I think, a perspective that shows that the real people who are involved in a city's history or in a political movement, how that's kind of, that's always going to be intertwined with what you're describing within your narrative. And I loved that in how it goes into this fragile friendship and relationship between these two women and what their romantic lives are like and how that can change for you at different ages and at different, you know, points in your life. I thought that was, it was really beautiful. And I think that Kapadia is, she would be of the films I've seen this year on my ballot for director, because I think of what she does with the form, but also it is a very classical film, but she captures, I think, so much beauty and so much volatility in Mumbai. And I thought that was just really, really exceptional. So I highly recommend this one as well. It doesn't have a US release date yet. Janus Films and Sideshow are distributing it in North America. I really wish that France would have selected this over Emilia Perez. Here I go again. Or that India would have selected it, because it was, you know, potentially going to be selected by either country, but it wasn't. So it's not going to get that needed Oscar boost of getting people to see it and check it out. So I will keep, I think, pushing it all year and recommending it to people, because I really do think it's one of the year's most beautiful films.
I also enjoyed it, I think, more for its beauty than actually really connecting to it, but that's not me trying to put the film down. It almost has this ghost-like quality to it and how they capture these three women. And I think, you know, with me, that can be hard sometimes. So I think that's my distance, but I did enjoy that one. Misericordia just went from crime thriller to noir to screwball comedy. And it was just like, where are we going? And there's a priest involved with this guy who's coming back after his ex-coworker has passed away, and they had some sort of relationship that's hinted at, but he's staying with his wife, his now widow, their house. It's just, there's a lot happening, and it didn't work for me. There were some critics who really loved this. I will say somebody has really loved every single movie that we will talk about today, regardless of how we feel. And that is kind of shocking to me, but you know, there's something for everyone, I think, at the end of the day. So whether we like them or not, I still recommend checking them out. Definitely The Seed of the Sacred Fig, definitely All We Imagine as Light, and Misericordia, if you liked Gorodi's Stranger by the Lake. I prefer that film. I think there are more profound layers there to discuss, but I would still recommend checking this out if you like his work.
Yeah, I think that's the benefit of film festivals, really. And I mean, just art in general. Someone is going to like it or even love it. And disagreeing is also fun, right? And there are some even here that we'll talk about this week or next week that we disagree on. And that, I think, always brings out the best conversation.
Right into the next section that I liked or loved. And we have disagreed on. So what a perfect transition there. These are films that you saw at Telluride. So off the bat, we have Maria, Nickel Boys, and Emilia Perez. I loved Maria. I have had lots of difficulties with Lorraine's other projects. within the trilogy, so Jackie and Spencer, but also El Conde from last year, which was in cinematography. I think he brings everything together with this film. I loved the movie. I loved the performances, namely Angelina Jolie. It was an experience watching this movie like I felt last year with Sandra Uller. Sorry for the hyperbole, but just realizing that you were watching something special and my performance of the year. So this is just the best thing I have seen come out of an acting performance this year. And I would happily see it again. I think the camera work, the sound work, the costumes, they are just all phenomenal components that all work with her. The first 5 minutes, it's this lovely intro into her life and realizing that we're seeing the last week of that. And we see her in 20 or 30 costumes, and it is just dazzling. I think the way she depicts Maria Callas is phenomenal. And then how they mix her voice with Maria's actual singing voice. There are lots of opera interludes and emotional asides with her. There's this really pretty sequence in the rain that brought me to tears as well. So this I was actually really surprised by, but I loved this one.
I was so happy that you loved it. Like I mentioned previously, this is my favorite entry into Pablo Larraín's trilogy of doomed women. I think that what also is really smart about the movie is that he understands that in the opera, women die all the time, right? Like a lead character will have a really extreme or dramatic death scene. And here, by starting really at the end with Maria's death, it allows us to enter this film as an opera really of its own. And I think that Angelina Jolie, like you said, she gives my favorite performance by an actress this year, for sure. I'll be rooting for her to win Best Actress. We'll see if that happens. I think we have a really exciting race coming up in that category. But yeah, it's a beautiful film. It's just really easy to get lost in. And like you said, because of the production design and the costumes and Ed Lachman's absolutely flawless cinematography, it's a really, really beautiful movie. So I'm glad that you really liked it too. And this will be coming out in theaters limited November 27th, and then we'll be on Netflix December 11th.
And then with Nickel Boys, I think I appreciate your disclaimer previously that it's a difficult movie, but it's also a masterpiece and brilliant and beautiful. I think that's a perfect way to talk about it because of its perspective, how the camera takes on the POV of the boys in this story. So if you've read the novel, I think that does help in ways in interpreting how they show the story happen. Jomo Frey's camera work, I mean, it's one of a kind. It's spectacular in how in the beginning he shows these shots a lot from the trailer, actually, of like Elwood looking up from under the Christmas tree and laying under an orange tree. And then how later when he's imprisoned in this camp for boys called Nickel Academy, he reuses those experiences, but now he's put to work. He's picking the oranges off the trees and not just laying underneath the tree, not listening to his grandmother, or putting up Christmas lights around the facility and not laughing with his Nana like before. So it's a very hard watch. You're seeing racism happen in the most gruesome ways. And I think a lot of that cinematography also captures that under the surface. But I think seeing this relationship between Elwood and Turner is remarkable. These actors capture the light within the darkness, and you somehow always feel hope, even though there really isn't any. It's devastating, but captured in such a beautiful way. I really enjoyed it. Again, it's hard to maybe love this movie, but on paper, thematically and critically, it's a knockout.
Yeah, I do love it personally. So what you said too about it being gruesome, I disagree, because I think that what I appreciate about it is just that it's so different from other films about racism or the Jim Crow South, where we don't actually see violence in a like trauma porn way, which I feel like a lot of directors do like to perpetuate on screen. And audiences have honestly become accustomed to seeing that depiction. And what this does instead is it forces you to be in Elwood's perspective or to be in Turner's perspective, or as Ramel Ross describes it, this sentient perspective. I think what it's doing is it's putting you as close as possible to that violence. And it's saying, not only are you experiencing it with these characters, you are complicit in it. And that is something that I just like, I've never seen before. And to say it's an important film honestly sounds a bit trite, but why it, I think, is an essential, immense film. And it's also because of the cinematography and how you said, you know, it plays with these different images that he sees as a young boy and then he sees later in life experiencing that. I think that's what reminded me of the Tree of Life a little bit, and that kind of Proustian effect that seeing an object can make you suddenly remember a memory that you thought was lost before, or make you, you know, experience something in a new way. And I think for this film too, we'll talk a lot more about it as the year goes on, but the final shot of this movie, I think, is incredibly hopeful and beautiful. And that's not something that I expected necessarily from this, where the earlier images were leading you. And I have a million questions about this movie and things I want to talk about, but we can save that for when we do a deep dive into it.
Definitely. And last in this section, we have Emilia Perez. This is a wild movie in a totally different way.
You can say that again.
But I think actually, like, after hearing your reactions and seeing some of other people's, knowing that it had won multiple awards at Cannes, I was high on it. I enjoyed the audacity of it, and I really liked the music. I think from the opening number with Zoe Saldana, who is giving one of my favorite performances of the year, really hones in on this unique perspective. And I think that cues you into not trying to take it too seriously, which helped with the viewing. There are a lot of people who are against the movie, and I understand that, and I want to hear more of those perspectives. And those are relating to the trans experience and how they capture that. And we kind of dissect the character on screen in their transition. And I think that's a bit invasive, and that's why this movie is being protested. But I also enjoyed Carlos Sofia Gascon's performance. Really, all of the women, I mean, they deserve the Cannes Prize for Actress. And I think it was made in a way to appeal to most audiences. And I think that's what this movie is. Hopefully people will watch it when it's released on Netflix. I'm sure people will hate it, but I think I overall appreciate the intentions of the film and what ODR is trying to do with these characters. It is a bit traumatic and comical at times, you had said it, but I think overall I was pleasantly surprised, and it will provoke necessary conversations to be had, whether people are for it or against it.
Yeah. What did I say before you saw it, though, that I thought this was going to be one of our Siskel and Ebert entries this year where we were divided? And it's one of those movies where, and I've said this before, every year there's one where when I first see it, I think, what am I missing? Everyone loves this movie. What am I missing? And I try to convince myself that I like it, when in reality, when I just step back, I realize that it is just not working for me. And I left the movie, I would say, mixed negative on it, sort of right in the middle, but leaning more negative or dubious of it and its execution. And now I think the more time passes, the more negative I become on it. I would be curious what a rewatch would do, because we're going to have to talk about it all year. I think it is our front runner for international feature and will definitely be in a number of categories, as I agree. I think general audiences and voters in particular will like it. I think that they will, whether it's misguided or not, feel good about liking this movie. And that's always interesting when that happens. I think it's a bit regressive, but I will also say that I think the performances are great, especially Carla Sofia Gascón and Zoe Saldana. Zoe Saldana, I do think, runs away with the movie and should absolutely be in lead.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
This is a co-lead situation. But yeah, I'm excited to talk about it as the year goes on. The response out of New York Film Festival, I think, as far as critics and audience members go, is the lowest I've seen of all the festivals so far. Cannes and Telluride reviewed it pretty positively. Toronto was a bit mixed, and I think New York is mixed negative on it. It's always interesting when that happens.
Yeah. Runner-up at TIFF, that confused me. I think that should have been The Wild Robot, hands down, but I wasn't at TIFF.
Oh, yeah.
With Emilia, I totally agree about the performances. I think Zoe should be going lead, but I'm also happy because she's not up against Angelina. And I think she has a really good chance in supporting actress. So yeah, we'll talk about that more as the season goes on.
All right. And for our last two movies, we grouped these together and we're calling them Two Epic Tales of Architects because they really work as a unique double feature. One I find very successful and the other I thought was a complete misfire. The two movies we'll be talking about are Megalopolis from Francis Ford Coppola and Brady Corbett's The Brutalist. So I think let's start with Megalopolis. This wasn't an official selection of the New York Film Festival lineup, but they did have a special screening as part of the festival, which is also the New York premiere. And then it was also playing in IMAX locations around the country. And they were live streaming a Q&A with Francis Ford Coppola, Spike Lee, and Robert De Niro that was moderated by the film festival director, Dennis Lim. So I'm going to start with the Q&A before we get into the movie, mm-hmm. because I think that the Q&A was worth the price of admission alone and the 2 hours that followed. I was at the AMC Lincoln Square location where they were actually there in person for the Q&A. And I think the reason I'm saying that first is because you were at a different location where it was streamed. And I'm wondering if the audience reactions were maybe a little bit different because they were in the room in my theater and they weren't with you. But I think a New York rite of passage is attending a Q&A with Robert De Niro. And anyone who's done this before knows that if you give the man a microphone, he will talk about how much he hates Donald Trump, which, you know, I respect that. I was waiting for it. I thought we're close to the election. What's he going to say? And he did not disappoint. But basically, the Q&A was just Francis Ford Coppola telling a lot of stories about his past and about making The Godfather, Godfather Part II, Apocalypse Now, stories we've mostly heard. And then it just went completely off the rails in a way that I think the movie does.
The Q&A starting out, I was pleasantly surprised by. I think I was expecting something or Coppola to answer Dennis's questions almost as divisively as the reactions to the movie have been.
Mm-hmm.
But the Q&A started out really well. He had really thoughtful answers. And I was like, okay, I could be into this based on what he was saying about it and the power in what he was trying to say and get across. It sounded actually entertaining and valuable. And yes, I think as it went on and he started telling stories and Dennis asked, oh, like, how did you all meet each other? How did you, Spike, and you, Bob, meet Francis? And nobody really remembered, which was part of the fun. And I think in the end, it just came down to being in New York and Francis thought Spike was a student, I think, from a different school, or it was just all a mess at the end. And really not until you said there was a Q&A did I remember writing down the funniest things that Coppola had said, just because I had blocked out this entire experience from my memory already. This was maybe a week or two ago. And it was just divine. I mean, yes, we have Bob saying, just imagine Donald Trump directing this movie.
Which was great. Like, the fact that that was his entry point really into talking about his hatred for Trump and
yes.
saying he couldn't direct this movie. He can't do anything that requires a team and, you know, going off. It was just excellent. And Francis also, the scary part, it is all started because he said, you know, in a few months, the empire will fall. Like, he mm-hmm. went into this whole thing of like predicting how the election was going to go and this doom and gloom. We're going to learn the lesson of the movie here in real time
yeah.
in just a few months. And then Spike Lee, of course, who is just an amazing presence always at Q&As. Like, he is so funny. He's so charismatic. Great stories. You can see it in his eyes. He's like, wait. No, we have time. Like, we can do this. Everyone register to vote.
Mm-hmm.
It was so funny.
He really was channeling his "that's not my cup of tea" interview vibes in that mm-hmm. Q&A. Because also at one point, they're all like, yeah, Spike's my Italian brother. And it's just, again, very bizarre. But there were two asides that really had me chuckling from Coppola. And he was telling the story about growing up, and he says, "I lived off $1.25. 25 cents for breakfast, 50 cents for lunch, and then whatever was left over was for Kraft mac and cheese. And that's how I got so fat."
I know. That was a funny one.
And now I don't even remember the context of that, but I was like, okay, well. And then his other one was him talking about alcohol being good for you and his wine business and how that really mm-hmm. functioned as funding this film. And he goes, "It used to be that a glass of red wine was good for you. Now it's no alcohol." Like, where are we going?
I know.
What is this?
Well, and that works perfectly alongside him saying, you know, "My kids are filmmakers. They like that I have a wine business because wine is a good gift." He's great. They're all treasures, really. And I'm so glad that, as funny as it was, it just reminds you of how cool these people are and what they've done. And they're all, each of them, they're just one of a kind. There aren't stars mm-hmm. and directors like this anymore who speak like this in interviews and who have these types of stories to share. So,
right. Yeah,
like I said, totally worth the experience just to see that Q&A at the beginning.
And Francis had mentioned The Conversation, The Godfather Part II, movies and facts from those productions that we covered earlier this season. So, like, as he was prefacing things, I was like, yes, this. And then he would say that. And I was like, oh, my God, like, we know this. So check out those episodes if you want for all of those little fun facts that he mentioned during the Q&A. But it really did place that in a timeline that I could understand and maybe where these ideas came from, because this is like decades in the making. And I think let's talk about the actual movie now. I just don't think it played out as maybe he imagined in his mind.
Yeah, this is a tough one because, as we've discussed all season, we both really love the works of Francis Ford Coppola. It's difficult to even pick a favorite. The Godfather, The Godfather Part II, The Conversation, Apocalypse Now. We even covered Dracula last year.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that movie. So I went into this, though, I think knowing the highs and lows of Coppola and really, I think, just being ready for something different and exciting. And, you know, the reviews out of Cannes were very mixed, very all over the place, you know. And I think that I was going into it ready to, I think, give Coppola the benefit of the doubt because I love his other films so much. But there is a key moment during this movie that I think perfectly sums up my experience, which is that I pulled ibuprofen out of my bag in the middle of the movie because I had a raging migraine from what I was experiencing on screen. And the man sitting next to me nudged me and asked if I had ibuprofen, because he also had a headache, and if I could give him one. And I just, like, that, I think, sums it up. It is a lot of movie. There's so much going on. And I think I was not in the right headspace, possibly, to even have fun with it, because it is just so all over the place. And it's difficult to really understand where you are in the narrative, what's going on. It feels like someone telling you a story, and that's not always the easiest thing to lock into. I felt like every single person was in a completely different movie. Sometimes it felt like I was watching a community theater production. Other times I felt like I was watching, you know, something that I'd never seen before. And there were some really amazing visuals and I was excited to see what came next. But for the most part, this was a huge disappointment to me. And I think the reactions to this have been pretty volatile, just seeing people who hate it being really aggressive about it and people who love it saying that if you don't love this movie, you don't like movies. I can promise you, I love movies and I did not like Megalopolis. That is possible. But it's an experience. I do recommend that people see it because I have a hard time predicting like where people will fall on it because, I mean, reactions are always subjective, but I think to this one and what you get out of it, I don't even know.
Well, I think you're still giving it the benefit of the doubt. I will say that I do not recommend this experience to anybody. If you love seeing movies that are divisive, sure, go and see it. I just felt like I wasted 2.5 hours of my life. I don't even know how there was a longer cut of this movie. I don't think the problem here was that things were cut and that we didn't understand. I just don't really even know what was happening. Again, it was these ideas that he was getting across, sure. But in terms of a plot, we didn't really need 2.5 hours to explain all these different side stories and just so many different narratives and devices being used that, again, didn't really amount to anything. We have the little live question press conference in the middle there I don't even think was necessary. I applaud him trying to use art in this different sense, but I think it was just distracting because someone has to come on stage and I don't even think they got the lighting right in order to spotlight him.
They shined the flashlight right in my eyes. Like it was, again, just for the headache part of the movie.
Oh,
it got so bright. What is happening? And I knew this was coming too, but it just, again, it took me out of it. I think my recommendation for seeing it is just so people can join in on the fun of quoting it and knowing what's happening. Like the fact that there's a part about what will we name the baby? If it's a girl, Sunny Hope.
God.
If it's a boy, Francis. Like that is so...
My theater
what's
erupted
going on there?
At that moment.
It's so funny. And when Adam Driver, his delivery of go back to the club.
I work without caring what happens to either of us. So go back to the club, bear it all.
I couldn't stop laughing. Everything with Shia LaBeouf is absolutely haunted.
Mm-hmm.
And I never want to see a single moment of that for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
The moment when Chloe Fineman flubs a line and they keep it in.
Yeah.
It's just these things. I don't know what happens. John Voight, Aubrey Plaza. I'm just saying names now. It's just like
but
the movie.
It
doesn't make
sense.
Any sense.
Just unnecessary nudity. And again, this was one of our other like boner situations that was just so bizarre.
The worst one, though. I did want to leave during that little Robin Hood related scene. Yeah, it was near the end. Yeah.
We have this line that we'll give superlatives later, and this might be in the running for it, but there was this like oral anal line given by Wild Platinum, and it was just a mess. There's so much violence and darkness happening in New Rome, aka New York, in the future, that I was like, we're in Gotham. Like, where is Batman? When's he coming out?
Well, one of my favorite reviews, and I'm forgetting who the author of this is now, and I wish that I could remember, but they said that this movie is like Francis Ford Coppola was shooting a Batman movie and lost the rights in the middle of it.
Oh my God, yes.
I thought that was so perfect.
Just all of the CGI and the Greek or Roman statues falling apart. And I don't know, everyone felt evil. I think that's part of the idea of it all, is that there's no good side prevailing, but they do in the end, in a way. Again, see it if you must, but I am not on this movie's wavelength at all.
If you do see it, let us know what you think. I think our next movie about an architect, because, you know, in Megalopolis, Cesar Catalina is the one who is thinking of this utopian, idealistic future of New Rome. And our other architect movie is The Brutalist, which we saw together at the same screening.
Mm-hmm.
That was my second time seeing it. I am addicted to this movie. This is directed by Brady Corbett and stars Adrian Brody, Felicity Jones, Guy Pearce, Joe Alwyn. And I love this movie so much. It's my favorite movie of the year so far. I'm just stunned by it. It is 3.5 hours. It does have an intermission, and it flies by. And I'm not just saying that because everyone knows I like long movies, but it flies. There's nothing like it. I saw it in 70 millimeter and then I saw it again in 35 millimeter. What was your experience with it? I know we've talked about it quite a bit offline, but talk about what you thought of The Brutalist.
I have similar feelings. Firstly, about the runtime, I think the intermission is necessary in a way, not that anything is lagging or feels like you need a break, but I think it does help with the viewing experience. And by the end, I was like, it cannot be over. There must be another hour and a half.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, that was a ride. And I love it. I think it's one of the best of the year. It does, and it will provoke a lot of commentary and critical analysis. I think it's one of those that talking about certain shots or sequences or developments throughout the film will definitely enhance it. But it is just riveting from start to finish, getting to know these characters, seeing the downfall of capitalism and corporate ownership and what that does to these characters who are already traumatized by a past of living in the concentration camps. They talk about Buchenwald and Dachau quite a bit and how that relates to his work as an architect. And I think that was so fascinating. But from the very first shot and sequence, really, you're just awakened to this other world. And by the time the opening titles are flashing and they start scrolling, I mean, the scrolling alone was like, I'm going to need a minute. But that brassy tuba symphony of a score, just you feel it rattling your bones. And that was just amazing to me. Yeah, it's very hyperbolic. And I think this movie deserves all of that. And we talked about how people had compared it to The Godfather Part II or There Will Be Blood or, you know, all of these masterworks. I think there's also a lot of David Lean and Lawrence of Arabia in that, some of that just in the driving sequences alone. But it's a movie that should be praised and will be, and I think should be a top contender come Oscar time. And hopefully we'll have a great theatrical run. It was picked up by A24. So yeah, I'm just hoping the best for this movie.
Yeah, so it'll have a limited theatrical release on December 20th here in the States, and then we'll go out wide a little bit later. I think it will be very similar to The Zone of Interest and its release last year. I'm going to save a lot of my thoughts on the movie until more people can see it, because I think we'll have the best conversation when we can go really deeply into it. And just the only slight spoiler I will give is that if this movie does not get nominated for multiple Oscars, it will hands down be my write-in vote for every category of our contender series this year. So you will hear, there will be no shortage of us talking about The Brutalist.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I agree. I think it is just a fascinating study of the rot of the American dream, right? Mm-hmm. Of this false idea of what that is. And yeah, I'm just floored by it. I love it. I mean, it's my, every year I have a movie I'm obsessed with. This year I have two. I have The Brutalist and Challengers. And they're very, obviously very different, but in my world, Adrian Brody and Josh O'Connor would both have Oscars. So anyway, the David Lean comparison is interesting. The directors I was thinking a lot of were PTA in the first act. And then as we get into act two, I was thinking a lot of Polanski and Bertolucci. So it'll be a great discussion when it comes time for us to dig into the meat of that movie and what makes it so great.
There were some other movies that we've seen at the New York Film Festival so far, but we're going to continue our chat on those next week. I think to wrap up a little bit with these films and maybe some others that we haven't mentioned, or maybe that you or I have seen and the other hasn't, we just wanted to shout out some superlatives. So first off, favorite shot. What are some of your favorite compositions you've seen so far?
My favorite shot is one of the opening shots in The Brutalist. And anyone watching that movie will know exactly what I'm talking about. There are many shots I think that could fall into this category, but it is just this shot of the Statue of Liberty. And I'm not going to go into too much detail describing it because I want people to be surprised with how you experience that. But I mean, the first time I saw it, it was one of those things where I didn't realize I was crying, but I was crying. And then when I saw it with my sister, I looked over at her and she was also crying. It's overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And we just don't really get that in movies anymore.
Mm-hmm. That's also one of mine. I already have like a top five, which is crazy. I can't wait to see what we have at the end of the year. There were obviously some other ones from The Brutalist because the cinematography is just out of this world. But there's another one, he's smoking and there's like a sparkler behind him while he's drawing that I absolutely loved. Mm-hmm. And then there's another, it's one that reminded me of La La Land because they have this whip pan going on in the jazz club.
So
that was kind of a fun comparison. But I think my top two would be one from Vietnam, a movie that was difficult for me, but had some beautiful imagery. And there's one where there are two characters and one is looking in the other's ear. And there's a similar like sparkling happening behind that, but it looks like it's coming out of his ear and it is just spectacular. I think my other favorite so far, besides yours from The Brutalist, is from Nickel Boys. And it's when Turner swims underwater and sees Elwood's feet dangling in the water. And I think there's such a darkness to it, but there's a stillness as well. And it kind of captures their relationship as friends and how he reaches up for Elwood, but it cuts before anything happens. Not that it would, but I think that's just such a touching moment for them because it's also, they're not at Nickel and they can kind of be more of themselves and feel free. And that really took my breath away during that movie.
Yeah, I have a few from Nickel Boys too. I think my two favorites, there's so many. I think when we talk about this in more depth later, when it comes out, I'll just run down an entire list of what Joe Mauffre did. But when we see Nana Hattie ironing and the iron goes by and we see Elwood's reflection in it as a little boy, that is just, it's so beautiful the way that shot is composed. And I think my shot of the year, aside from the one from The Brutalist that I mentioned, is that shot of Elwood and Turner looking up at the mirrored ceiling at each other. It's this very like beautiful, intimate moment of friendship and their connection, how they see each other, how they see themselves, how we see them. And it's one of those moments where at first I think you don't know whose perspective you're in because that's when it started switching. And he gives you a little clue into that, that you're in Elwood's perspective, which I thought was just really, really beautiful. I mean, there are so many in that movie. It's just a visual feast.
Yep.
And then I would say, too, it's hard to pick one from Maria, but there are so many beautiful shots of Angelina Jolie. But I think if I had to pick one, I would probably pick the one of her, like the close-up black and white of her singing, just straight on, looking at the camera. It's like old Hollywood, beautiful old Hollywood glamour. The shots of her walking in the fur and leather coat by the Eiffel Tower in the fall. It's all so beautiful.
My cursed thought from Maria, because this was in the very beginning when they're intercutting to the black and white close-up of her singing, is that she does these like, and again, this might be an opera thing, but her lips like vibrate, like they're moving left and right. And it just reminded me of RuPaul and the lip syncs. Like a bad lip sync. And I was like, oh no, But from
That's
there,
definitely it's definitely an opera thing.
Okay.
It's definitely an opera thing.
But I also did have one from Maria. And there's a lot of great camera movement, and there's one where it 360s around her on stage, and I was just totally in awe of of that. Yeah.
But it's funny that you said that about RuPaul, because I think that RuPaul comes up on more episodes than not.
True.
No popes, please.
Yeah.
Okay. And then do you have any favorite quotes that you want to go through? Mine are all from Megalopolis.
I was going to say the funny ones are better than the serious ones. And now I can't find the funny ones. But one that I think sums up the Brutalist really well for me, and it was really early on, was them talking about the company, Millers and Sons.
Mm-hmm.
And he just goes, no Miller, no Sons. And that just kind of sums up America also in four words, and how it's all a facade, which is chilling.
There are a lot of great lines like that. I also think, and Guy Pearce is so good in the movie, he, in playing Harrison Van Buren, has so many lines that I've just caught myself saying now, which is scary because he's obviously the villain. But his line deliveries are so good when he's just like, what a poetic reply. And he's just, it's that like classic American wealth. I can't wait for more people to see the movie and to talk about that performance too. But I mean, all of my quotes, when you put this in the outline, I was really only thinking of Megalopolis.
Please.
And figured we would talk about our good scripts later. So the one you were referencing, after we saw the movie, we said we would have a cursed quote off. And my favorite cursed quote that I cackled when I heard this during the movie and was also horrified was when Wow Platinum, Aubrey Plaza says, "You're anal as hell, Caesar. I, on the other hand, am oral as hell."
Yeah.
Who wrote this? Why?
I didn't even take notes during this movie, and I think it was very clear very quickly that I didn't need to, but maybe I should have in a different sense. That is probably one of the worst lines.
It's really bad. The best is go back to the club. Adam Driver.
Well, it's his line reading, yeah.
Aubrey Plaza has some of the worst lines, and I also hated how Shia LaBeouf's character calls her Auntie Wow. Anyway.
What was the sequence where Natalie Emanuel as Julia just like keeps repeating herself? That was also terrible.
And you think 1 year of medical school entitles you to plow through the riches of my Emersonian mind?
Entitles me?
Yes.
Entitles me?
Yes.
Entitles me?
Yes.
I had some from Maria because I think they just speak in parables in that movie, but I think it's done beautifully. Angelina is just so witty as Maria Callas. There are a lot of one-liners that play really well comedically. I do have one really funny one from Amelia Perez.
Oh, God.
And it's not from the song. There is from Penis to Vagina that I think took me out for a moment. But it's Selena saying, "My pussy still hurts when I think of you."
That sums up the dialogue of Amelia Perez.
There is more nuance. That is, I think, the worst of it. But there are little instances that maybe take you out, and that is definitely one of them.
My favorite is when the doctor I'm not going to sing on the pod because I cannot sing, and I'm going to spare everyone. But when he just sings back to her, "Lady," that made me laugh so hard. It's something else.
Yeah.
But the Maria lines, it's Stephen Knight again, and he wrote Spencer, and it does, I think, fall victim to some of those cliches in writing. Like, there is one that made me roll my eyes. "She was his wife, but you were his life." But I think it works better here than it did in Spencer because it fits with opera and that, you know, type of storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
But there were some of those where I thought, okay, you're leaning a little, you know, the metaphors are a bit obvious. You're literally rhyming now.
Yeah. And then I think just one more here. What is your best New York Film Festival moment or sighting? It could be celebrity or otherwise, because I think a big part of this festival for us, or at least for me, is going to these films and most of them having Q&As with the cast and crew afterwards, which I think is just delightful.
There's so many fun ones. I think from this portion of the festival, this is going to sound so silly, but going to opening night of Nickel Boys and seeing my name on the poster was surreal. Just seeing that outside of Lincoln Center, I had to stop myself and just like say a lot of little thank yous. That Q&A was also great. And then I would say too, I mean, seeing Angelina Jolie, that's not an experience you ever expect to have. So when that happens, you think, okay, I'm in the presence of a movie star. And I think some of it too is just like being in the lobby and like I was, you know, waiting for The Brutalist and I met Celine Song and Justin Kuritsky's because they were just in the lobby.
My gosh.
And it's just those sorts of things I think are really cool because they're also just there to see the movie because they've heard good things about it. And Justin Kuritsky's, who wrote Challengers, also wrote Queer. So he's, you know, has a film at the festival. Celine Song with Past Lives, obviously also a New York filmmaker and playwright. It was just those sorts of things I think are the really great experiences.
Mm-hmm. I haven't had any crazy audience encounters, but I will say the Q&As for Megalopolis, like we talked about, The Brutalist, and Amelia Perez. I think having Selena Gomez there, Carla Sofia Gascon, and Zoe Saldana. Zoe, she had this like really shimmery red dress on that was just absolutely gorgeous. And it kind of mirrors what she wears in the movie. She has this really beautiful red suit that she wears during a dance sequence and a song. And she absolutely kills that number. But seeing her in real life was another surreal moment. And just hearing her speak about her performance, The Brutalist, Adrienne Brody, Felicity Jones. I mean, that was just, oh yeah, Adrienne, because we were texting.
Wait, can we talk about this?
And he had this white shirt on and he was sitting rather provocatively. And there's a scene in the movie that he's nearly naked in that I was shocked by, to say the least. But
oh, at the beginning?
Yeah.
We were texting about that afterwards, like we were children. But yeah, he's great at Q&As too. He was very funny and shared a really beautiful story about his mom too. Yeah. And I just kept thinking, I want to hear more from him all season because it is just such a great performance. But he is also really personally connected to the material. And yeah, he looked great. Good job to whoever his stylist is. And if anyone follows him on Instagram, his Instagram came up recently. I know we talked about it a little bit a few weeks ago. But he thanked Kim Kardashian in his post, and I wondered what that was from. And I learned that it's because Kim Kardashian got him and Adam Brody confused, and she thought that Adrienne Brody was in the show with Kristen Bell.
Oh, my God.
So he just said, thank you, Kim Kardashian, as a reference to that, which is so funny.
Okay, I love that even more now, because I looked it up, and I was like, there's no way Kim's a producer on this movie, and she isn't, but that is hilarious.
She donated $10 million of her own money. That's the budget. Okay, our final wrap-up question. If you could give any of these movies that we've talked about today one Oscar, what would it be?
I really think it could be a year that things are spread out pretty evenly. I say that now and watch in a few months it won't be, but I have to give The Brutalist Best Picture. I'm glad we're not talking about another movie that we saw that I think could also win Best Picture, but I think for this episode, I will say that. And I hope that's not jinxing it, but I think it does also have potential apart from me wanting that. What about you? What is your one Oscar for these films?
Okay, that was my answer too.
Okay, great.
So we're aligned, The Brutalist, Best Picture. I mean, there are so many other ones we could say.
I think we would both agree on Angelina Jolie as actress and that.
Mm-hmm.
I know you have others, but yeah, we can save those two.
Yeah, I would say those two are where we're really aligned right now. But yeah, The Brutalist for Best Picture. Let's do it. Another 3-hour epic. I'm ready. I'm here for it. Come on, A24.
Yeah.
Don't let us down.
Well, next time on Oscar Wilde, we'll be talking about even more New York Film Festival. We'll be reviewing some other films. I saw Hard Truths today. Anora came out at the beginning of the festival, but it will have a wide release once that next episode is released. So we'll be talking about that and Queer and all the other films that we've seen throughout the festival through the end. So I'm looking forward to chatting about those as well.
Yeah, I can't wait to continue our New York Film Festival discussion. Thank you all for listening. If you like our show, please feel free to rate, review, and follow. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok at Oscar Wilde Pod, and bonus content at patreon.com/Oscar Wilde.
Check out our updated nomination predictions. We are releasing new categories every week at oscarwilde.squarespace.com. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next time.